Let's talk about the rules of development. Now, the rules of development or the laws of development will not be your development plan. You will have at some point, hopefully, a development plan that lists out what you're doing, how you're doing it, the brochures you have, the contacts you're making, the communications things that you're doing. So this is not your development plan, but it's something that's going to impact and affect your development plan. You will see aspects of these rules and laws within your plan. As you meet with people, you'll go, oh, that was just the rule of relationships or the rule of advice. You'll begin to see that as you begin to work on your development plan. And again, they're not hard and fast rules. If you're familiar with the old Disney Pirates of the Caribbean, they're more like guidelines, maxims for things that we experience or see within our development work. So there's no particular order, there's no particular priority, so some will impact you more than others, and we're just gonna go through them. The premise here for me is a little bit like the law of gravity, right? My shoes change, the steps I take change. If I'm walking on a sidewalk, the path is very different if I'm climbing a mountain. The law of gravity doesn't change. I will experience the law of gravity if I misstep and decide to take a tumble, which I've done before. So the law is not going to change. The environment that I'm in does change. So just as the environment around your organization and ministry changes, these laws, these rules, these maxims will not change very much over time. So I'm just going to take them in the order that they're on the slides. And again, this is not a priority order. This is not the order that you may experience them. Talk about the 80-20 rule. Wilfred Pareto, an Italian social scientist back in the, 1920s, actually did a survey at one point and realized at that time, 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the population. And that's become a maxim for lots of different business and ministry applications. When I was in an educational group, we had probably 80% of our activity came from 20% of the school districts that we worked with. 80% of your volunteer hours probably come from 20% of your volunteer base. And 80% of your funds will probably come from roughly 20% of your donors. It's just a maxim. Your mileage may vary. Your results may vary. But this is something I have to keep in mind because it is so consistent and has been so consistent over time across a lot of different applications, not just development, not just fundraising. So what it means for us in a real practical sense is we need to realize, in some respects, we need to make sure that we know who that 20% is comprised of. And when I said that, I suspect you probably had people's faces come to your mind. There were people in your database that said, oh yeah, that's one of the people that supports us. That's one of the faithful givers. That's one of the people that is so gracious and giving of their time as a volunteer. And that's the good news. Other news is, if your donor base gets really big, you're gonna have a hard time identifying them individually. And I may know a few, you may know a few, someone else may know a few. We don't have a good handle on the total number of people that are providing an inordinate amount, the majority of our funding and the majority of our volunteer time. Did anybody have a name or a face come to you when I mentioned this? Okay, several. Yeah. This is a U.S. study, so I'm not sure how this plays in Europe, but I will tell you that even that 80-20 rule is now starting to change in the United States. So now we're seeing even fewer numbers of donors providing even greater numbers of dollars in terms of that percentage. So it's probably leaning more towards an 85-15 rule, which doesn't sound nearly as, you know, easy to roll off the tongue as 80-20. But it just is a fact of life in the United States, and people are realizing that we got to find a way that the risk there is, if we're starting to lose one or two of those real consistent donors, then we start to lose a fairly significant amount of our overall annual income just by perhaps losing one or two donors. And we may lose them for very practical reasons. They retired and have less income now. They moved away. They had a life change situation. I got a call yesterday from a good friend of mine. He went to see his doctor last week, and the doctors called him today or yesterday, this is in the United States, and said, by the way, you have some pretty major heart issues. We're going to admit you to the hospital right now. So whatever he planned on doing this week is not going to happen because he's getting operated on probably right now. So things change in the life of our donors and our partners. So again, 80-20, but even in the States, again, it's starting to change. And that puts organizations a little more at risk in terms of if we lose somebody for whatever reason, we have a chance of losing a fairly significant dollar amount or euro or whatever to our organization. So the questions you need to ask yourself, and you can do this in the database, who are the 20% of our donors? And if your database or spreadsheet allows you to sort by amount, then you can sort by amount and have the highest level donors first, and you begin to count down, so it's all in order. And my guess is, because I've done this with other organizations, is if you get like, if you have 100 people in your database, and so you have, you know, 20% of that would be 20 individuals, and you sort it by dollar amount, highest to lowest, and you go down 20 people and count that, then add up that total and see what percentage of that, of your giving that is. It's a way to test that. We've helped people in most of our organizations, the clients we work with, because they've been able to kind of work in a relational way, that theme, that trend tends to be more 70-30 instead of 80-20. And we think that's a good thing. You have less reliance on a fewer number of donors. Not always the case, but that's possible. But that literal display or array of your database, your sales spreadsheet, you can kind of quickly determine what's the percentage there. Let's move to the next one. Again, not in order, no priority. Rule of linkage. We already talked about this a little bit, right? So then again, it's the likelihood that someone's going to respond and engage with you based on their linkage to your organization. Natural linkage, people already connected. Created linkage, people that we want to go, or groups of people we want to go create linkage with. And we had that conversation a couple of days ago. You go back and check your notes. But again, this is pretty important. As we think about what we do, the likelihood of someone engaging in us if they have no linkage, you know, me sending a note to Bill Gates asking him for some money is not going to happen probably. And if I was smart, I wouldn't ask him to give me money. I'd ask him to be a volunteer. I'd ask him to serve on my board because I want lots of years with Bill Gates or someone equivalent, not just the one gift, even though it could be substantial. So this linkage thing is pretty important. And a lot of times what I find is organizations don't focus on this and they don't really maximize it. So they kind of focus on an individual or a couple of individuals instead of a group of individuals or a group of people that all have the same connection to you or could have the same linkage to you. The rule of communication that has nothing to do with what we just talked about last hour. One-on-one is good if you're going to have a conversation with somebody, right? As opposed to one-on 300. We think two-on-one is better. So if I'm the development officer and I'm going to have a conversation with somebody about a gift or an invitation to be a board member or an invitation to be a volunteer, a significant volunteer, I want someone to come with me. I'm doing the presentation because I know the information best. But because I'm giving the presentation, there may be nonverbal reactions, there may be body language, there may be questions that are being asked that I'm not understanding because I'm focused on what I'm trying to present on. So I always invite someone to come with me. Could be a board member, could be a volunteer, could be a church pastor because I'm meeting with someone from their church. And I kind of try to determine best I can who's the best person to go with me. Who has the best relationship with the individual that I'm talking to? I may not know that individual. As a consultant, a lot of times I don't. So I have to have someone from the ministry or organization come in and help me introduce that, set the meeting up, schedule it, get it going, and I come into the presentation because I know what the content is. I know what the specifics are about the appeal or the invitation. So two-on-one gives you another set of eyes, another set of ears, and a way to go back and process or debrief at the end of the appointment what happened. Again, you gotta be a little bit careful and use some discretion, and again, for me, this comes down to prayer, in terms of who's the best person to go with you. I always try to go with the relationship first. Who's got the relationship with the individual that we're meeting with? Short of that, sometimes you kind of have to look at the organization that they work with and try to match up a little bit of the hierarchy of or structure of that group. So for instance, if I'm going in to meet with the CEO of a corporation, I probably want the head of my organization with me. So we have executive to executive. Or perhaps another CEO who's part of our team that can do the invitation, so you kind of match up, you know, for lack of a better phrase, power to power or authority to authority. Because me just calling on somebody, hey, would you please meet with us? Probably isn't going very far. So this is not my ideal way to do that. I'd always go for the relationship quality first. Who knows the person best? But sometimes we have to match this up. Rule of specificity. We spend a lot of time and energy putting together materials and packets and a brochure and collateral material to hand to people. And we slide it to them across the table, or we give it to them in a group meeting. We say, won't you please help? Help do what? Help how much? Help in what aspect? And many times I think we as believers, I heard someone say this once in the States, we get these holy humblers about ourselves. We just don't feel like we can ask, because we feel like that's not the right thing to do. We believe in asking. You have not because you ask not. So think about, again, this for me, this gets back to bridging. If you're leading with your vision, and you've given them what God is doing in your organization and ministry, and the relationship allows it, then you are simply inviting them, join God where He's at work in your ministry. And at that point, I'm just praying that God shows them how they are to use their resource. Now, deep down inside, I'm confessing that I want them to support and resource my organization. However, if they say no, if they say not now, if they say maybe later, I need to be okay with that. But if I get them at the table and I'm talking to them, or even a small group of people, and I don't give them the opportunity to really know what they're investing in, to really know what God is doing, then I've not done a good job of casting vision for how God is working in our organization and where we see God working in the future. So people argue and arm wrestle with me. Does that mean you want to specifically say, we want you to give this amount this many times, that sort of thing? And I would always defer to the relationship. If it's a higher value donor, someone's probably going to give a little more money, I will not ask them to give on the spot. I will ask them, I'll have all the materials, give it to them, ask them to consider that prayerfully, and then I'll ask them, can I call you in a couple of weeks to see if you have any questions? And then follow up with them. I think I gave the example of the one care center who, as they're doing their feasibility study for the capital campaign, that people are sliding checks across the desk to them for like $5,000-$10,000. Praise God. And that person probably had a whole lot more money that they could have given had we structured the specific ask differently. Funny story that Jerry tells. He's been doing it a lot longer than I have. He was, this university that he worked with early on was doing a big capital campaign and had to raise a lot of money. And there was a woman in the community who was a graduate of the school, and she was a nurse, and this was going to be a nursing building. And he knew he had to ask her, you know, for a fairly large amount of money. And he was going to ask her for $250,000 US, and this is 30 years ago. It was a lot of money, still a lot of money. And she invited him to the house when he set the appointment, and they had dinner together in her dining room, and they're having this conversation, and Jerry's just, you know, kind of hemming and hawing and not getting the point and can't really get the point where he can ask and can't really, you know, bring himself to say something. And finally, you know, they've had coffee, they've had dessert. I mean, it's time for him to go home. And he said everything around the conversation except for what he had to ask. And finally, he said, would you prayerfully consider considering a check for $250,000? This woman gets up from the dining table, walks to her office, comes back, and writes him a check for $250,000. And Jerry said, at that moment in my life, I realized I would never ask for a specific amount again. Because if she could write a check for that, she could have written for more, right? So like 3-4 years later, they've had the campaign, they've got the building, they've built it, and they're having some opening, you know, grand opening. And she came up to him and said, Jerry, you remember that night when he came to dinner at my house?
Yes.
I was really afraid that you were going to ask me for $500,000, because that's the amount that God put in her heart. So by asking an amount specifically, so it's a little bit of a tense and contradiction. And she did give that gift, by the way, at the end of the day. But so just like, I will never ask for someone for a specific dollar amount again, because I need to have let God work in their life. Rule of vision. You've heard me talk about this all week long. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Say it with me. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Okay, yeah, you guys got that. Rule of advice. This is kind of a fun one. Kind of another maxim. If you want advice, ask for money. If you want money, ask for advice. I wish I had a dollar or more for every time I went to somebody with a proposal of some kind to have them give me money, invite them to participate in something, and they're kind of looking at it, we have the conversation, they say, well, you know what? I think this is an interesting idea, but you know, that building or that neighborhood you're talking about having your church in, that's not a very good neighborhood. You know, I worked with a developer there once and it was a very bad experience, or whatever. They have lots of reasons and excuses not to give you money because you're asking for money. However, I go in and say, you know what, we're thinking about doing a new church plant. Here are a couple areas we've talked about. You know this area, you know this neighborhood, you know this community better than I do. What would be your counsel or advice for a new church plant or for a thing to do? We had a school in Arizona, a Christian school, that wanted to raise a lot of money to build a new building, and it was a Lutheran school. So they ended up kind of identifying these people who were Lutheran business people, men and women who owned businesses, but who were Lutheran, who went to Lutheran churches in the area. And they actually convened a little breakfast. The superintendent of the school, headmaster, talked about the school, what's going on. And then we just started asking them questions. You know, what would be a good reason to have a Lutheran school in this area, or to expand the Lutheran school, or to bring all the grades together into a common building? And you could almost feel the room change, because the I and the me turned to us and we. Or all of a sudden, the people started saying, well, you know, I don't think you'll have very much luck be able to do this in this neighborhood, but I know someone who knows that neighborhood. I know someone who knows who owns that piece of property. I know someone who can help you. And all of a sudden, the whole group, the whole mood of the room, about 30 people, changed, because all of a sudden they became champions, advocates. They had a linkage they created with this group of Lutheran business people. And those Lutheran business people went out and did the actual work of raising money from the other people in their churches. And they raised an incredible, significant amount of money, much shorter than they would be able to, because they were asking for advice first. Give us your counsel. Give us your ideas. And almost every time, if you're asking someone for their advice and their counsel, they begin to buy in to your vision and buy in to what your organization is doing. Not every time, but you've at least built a partner in that respect if you haven't built a donor. Rules of five. These are kind of disparate, but they kind of fit together. I think I mentioned this earlier, that usually every 5-7 years, you're going to see some turnover. You're going to see some change in your database. It's fully normal, completely natural. We haven't talked at all about capital campaigns earlier. I've given some examples of that. We haven't talked about the nuts and bolts of that. Well, we may do that a little bit in year-end mentoring this year. But we would say you don't go into another capital campaign within 5 to 7 years of the previous campaign. So you build a building, a church builds a building, and they have a new worship center, and all of a sudden they're filled to the capacity again, because the rule of church building is you'll have about 80% of your capacity no matter what. You won't get bigger than that. So if you want to grow bigger than that, you need a bigger worship center. So most churches say, well, great, we need to do an expansion and do a bigger worship center. If you're doing it within like 5 years of when you already completed the building, people probably haven't recovered from the last capital campaign in terms of their donations, or they moved on to other things in the meantime. So I would probably not do a capital campaign within 5 to 7 years of the previous campaign. And we have some charts actually kind of bear that out. But again, a rule of thumb. Never ask a volunteer to do more than 5 things a year. I get all sorts of wonderful questions and pushback on this, and I'm fine with that. So, well, gosh, Greg, I have someone that, you know, does something for us every week. Is that like, that's like 52 times. Is that too many? Well, it's one activity as opposed to 5 times of the same activity. And again, this is a guideline. You'll have to kind of figure out, but if you have 80% of your volunteer time coming from 20% of your volunteers, you got to figure a way that they don't get burned out and they don't get too busy and they don't feel like they have a way to either do something else within the organization or an opportunity to maybe move into a new role or move out of the organization, because Christian school is a good example. You know, the son and the daughter both graduated and are at university. Will mom and dad stay as a volunteer for that school? Maybe, probably not. So kind of think about that in terms of how you work with volunteers. So it might be that this person volunteers for you 1 hour every 2 weeks in the office. And maybe they also were a table host at a banquet. And then maybe they helped you convene a small group meeting with pastors in the area. So those would be 3 in a given year. So that's kind of how I start to count those in terms of the 5 times or 5 ways that people volunteer for you. Does that make sense? A little bit? Okay. I would always keep track every year on how many donors are not responding to your appeals. So if you have someone who gave a gift and they didn't give the next year, if that happens like at a 5% level over a given year, I would start to pay attention to that. Something's happening. It's either the expectations that you're setting, it's the way you're communicating. Maybe some of those people have not been able to give on an ongoing basis year after year because of something in their life. But if that's the case, I want to know about it. What's happening in their life that's causing them not to give might be something for us significant that we need to come in and enter into a ministry situation with them. And just understand they're not in a position to give us money. But that's something to keep track of in your data, in your database. And I always do this. People give me pushback on this all the time. I always want to set 5 different objectives or goals for any specific event or activity I'm doing. Example, I'll go back to the banquet. We have a goal of how many people we want to attend. We have a goal of how many new people we want to attend. I've been to some banquets that go year after year after year, and pretty soon it becomes a reunion, and it's the same 5 couples at the same table every single year. And that's great because they're probably all giving, or they wouldn't come back year after year. But is there a way to expand and then coach the table host to say, let's make sure that at your table of 8 or 10 people, that at least 2 of those couples are new and haven't been to this event yet. Let's talk about maybe how many volunteers we have at this event. We want to have more volunteers at this event than last year. So that might be a goal. We might have a goal as far as how many public relations announcements go out. We're going to talk to a local Christian radio station and get an advertisement or get a poster in all the churches. You can build non-financial goals. Then there's probably also a financial goal. We want to raise this amount of money. But if you have the other non-financial goals, then people have other things they have to focus on and realize that these are all ways to build toward the goal of the dollar amount, but we do it through certain ways. And we're making sure we have new people come to the event. We'll make sure that new people come to things that we're doing. This is a little bit harder in a newsletter or in a communications vehicle to try to come up with that. But certainly, at least for an event, I would focus on the financial goal, because that's important, obviously, but focus on some non-financial goals that will help you build the relationships with people for future work. Cubby holes. My dad, when I was growing up, had this big old antique roll-top desk, you know, where the roll kind of comes down and covers it. And he liked that because he could roll the top down and hide the mess that was behind it. Sometimes I wish I had that desk still. And it had all these little wooden boxes, wooden, you know, kind of slots and files. I call them cubbies. There might be a more technical term. But I knew that when Dad was sitting at his desk that his insurance papers went in this slot. And his employment papers went in this slot. And his homeowner information went in this slot. And the insurance went in this slot. And this slot over here is where my grade cards were. And that's a slot I didn't want him to look at. That was a joke. Didn't want him to look at my grades. Okay, that's all right. But everything was in the right place in relation to where he was sitting. As best we can, build cubbies for people so they know where they are in relationship to us. Talked about some of these in the bridging conversation yesterday. Are there ways to connect people together and make them a part of a cubby or an affinity group sometimes that really they know where they belong in the life of the organization? They know their part in the organization. They know what role they play in the vision that we're trying to accomplish. Could be volunteers, could be donors, could be advocates, could be ambassadors to the local church. Pregnancy care centers do a great job of assigning someone or attracting someone who goes to a particular church who becomes their ambassador, for lack of a better term, in that church and helps communicate their message in that specific local church to that local congregation. So then they have a whole strategy for those individual ambassadors or those church representatives in terms of how they work. And then if you can use Canva or other communications vehicles, you begin to tailor communication and information for that particular group. So they may get a regular newsletter every month, but they may be getting a special, targeted, identified, tailored types of information because of who they are and because of what cubby that they're in. Rule of turf. Moving on. If you're meeting with someone, having a conversation with someone, and this tends to lean more toward one-on-one conversations. If you're working with a high, very busy, active business person, man or woman, and you're meeting in their office, their pager's going off, their text is going off, their phone's ringing, they're getting interrupted by staff, and you may not have their complete focus. If you're meeting in a neutral spot, a restaurant, someone else's home, that sort of thing, then that's a really good place to have a meeting because hopefully they'll turn their phone over and won't take the call. So want to meet not on their turf perhaps, but on neutral turf or your turf, your place. So if you're having them come to your place, because you have a ministry where it allows for tours, this could be a school, this could be a food bank, this could be any one of several types of ministries, and it makes sense to give them a tour of our organization, a tour of the operations, that's a great way to bring them in. If you're doing that, make sure that your phone's off and you're not taking distractions as you're having the conversation with them. And I encourage to do this maybe groups of people. Doesn't have to be one-on-one, but invite the pastors to come in to your organization for a pastor's breakfast once a year or twice a year. And by the way, invite their spouses because they're making decisions as a couple, not so much financially, but just how they operate as a family. And many times it's those spouses of pastors who become your strongest advocates, not because the pastor was a strong advocate, but because she came with the pastor to an event where they saw what you do and they were able to catch vision for what you're trying to accomplish. So lots of ways to do that. Now, that's not saying don't ever go to the person's place of work. Just know, I would suggest you try to find either a neutral spot or have them come to your place and then you turn your phone off so you don't get the disruptions and distractions. Rule of timing. This is a very US-based example, so it may not make a lot of difference for you, but just hear me out. I think there are better times of the year sometimes than others to ask for money. I think there are better times of the year sometimes than to ask for volunteers. And so much of that will be driven by your country calendar, by your school calendar. I think I said earlier that in terms of newsletters, the school calendar in the States goes from like September to May. So I would do one newsletter each of those months and maybe one in the summertime. I tend not to ask people for money the first 2 weeks of April in the United States because April 15th is when we all file our taxes for the previous year. And if I have a tax bill, I'm paying that and I'm not giving you money because I've just sent it to the government. So your situation is different, I understand that. And every country is different when it comes to that. Prospect rule. If you need, I'll make up a number, $2,000 for something that you're doing, euros, and you want four gifts of $500 to accomplish that $2,000, you will probably need 16 or 20 people who have the capacity to give you $500 in order to achieve those four gifts of $500. There's a bit of a ratio here. And again, it's not completely hard and fast, but if you're going into a big campaign and you know you want X amount of money, you can look at your donor base and say, do we have the capacity to raise this amount of money based on what we know? And if you can say yes to that right away, then you're probably not asking for enough money by faith. And if you can look at that and say, well, gosh, even in our annual campaign or annual giving, we would be hard-pressed to come up with this amount of money based on our current donors, then you have some more strategizing to do. You have some more relationships to build. But just as a rule of thumb, you'll need probably 3 to 4 people capable of giving you that level of gift in order to achieve one gift of that level. And again, it kind of goes back to giving charts, and I wish I had more time to go into that. But just know that if you said, hey, we got 4 people last year that gave us this amount of money, great. That doesn't mean they give you that amount of money this year. So you need to be prepared to have other people available who might have the capacity to give you that level of gift.